Okay, the third argument for this morning is Corson County Board of Commissioners versus Curtis Hanks for the appellant, Board of County Commissioners, Mr. Thomas E. Simmons from Rapid City, and for the appellee, Curtis W. Hanks, is Mr. Elton R. Anson, attorney from Lemon. Mr. Simmons, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before this court today. This is my first time before the Supreme Court, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to do so. The court today is asked to step into, examine, and define some of the parameters of a very unique attorney-client relationship, that between a state's attorney and his or her board of county commissioners in the civil area. And I think it's important at the outset to distinguish between that type of representation that a state's attorney provides to his county as distinguished from criminal prosecutorial tasks. Essentially, what's presented to the court is a matter of statutory interpretation, of looking at the existing statutory framework and the case law that we have in place in light of a question that asks whether a contract entered into by the Corson County Board of Commissioners on January 7th, 2003 is a valid exercise of that county's power. Ultimately, the statutes don't give us an answer. Ultimately, there is a gap within the existing framework that does not provide a precise answer to that question. But I do believe that a review of and an overview of the existing statutory framework that is in place is helpful to see how we believe that there is and should be authority for the county to engage a law firm for civil representation, as was done here. We start with the statutory authority that counties are vested with. SDCL 7820 sub 1 provides that the Board of County Commissioners shall have the power to institute and prosecute civil actions in the name of the county, for and on behalf of the county. That is a power vested with the county and the County Board of Commissioners. We then look to the state's attorney chapter, that's 716. Within that chapter is a number of duties and responsibilities of the state's attorney, and I'll list the primary ones for you. It's our position that those duties and responsibilities are just that. They're responsibilities that a state's attorney may not refuse to perform. They are not an exclusive right to perform those duties. They are not a task that the state's attorney has any exclusive right or right of first refusal to perform, and the statutes don't suggest that. Here are the basic duties that a state's attorney is charged with. SDCL 716.9 provides that the state's attorney shall appear in all courts of his county and prosecute and defend on behalf of the state or his county all actions and proceedings, civil or criminal, in which the state is interested or a party. That's the obligation of a state's attorney, to participate in both criminal and the prosecutorial side and civil representation involving his county on matters venued within the county.
Well, you lost me just a little bit. First of all, 716.9 provides the state's attorney shall appear in all courts of his county and prosecute and defend on behalf of the state or his county all actions or proceedings, civil or criminal, in which the state or county is interested or a party. Then 716.2 says the circuit court, whenever there shall be no state's attorney for the county, or when the state's attorney is absent or unable to attend to his duties, or is adversely interested or disqualified, may appoint by an order to be entered and so forth some duly licensed attorney and consular at law. So don't you have to establish that that the state's attorney is absent or unable to attend to his duties, or is adversely interested or disqualified? Or aren't you preempting the voters and selecting your own state's attorney for civil matters?
We don't believe that we are, Justice Sabers. We believe that the county is attempting to carry out its statutory duties and responsibilities to the best of its ability. It's not displacing the state's attorney in terms of any criminal matters. It's not reducing his salary or budget in any way. It's not displacing the statutory duties that he's beholding to perform but it's selecting certain duties that it believes would be better served by another attorney.
Isn't it displacing the state's attorney as to all civil matters that you're hiring someone else for?
That's a very good question, Justice Sabers, and no, there's not evidence in the record that the state's attorney was displaced. Basically, the only evidence that was entered in the record before is the contract itself. There was no evidence put on the record as to whether the state's attorney was precluded from participating in any way in the duties that he felt obligated to perform.
Well, isn't it obvious that the state's attorney is going to be displaced as to all the things that the contract covers?
I don't think that's necessarily true. I can certainly envision a circumstance where that could happen.
So you can have two state's attorneys doing the same thing?
Well, I don't think that's what the contract envisions. There is a statement from Attorney Bogue within the transcript that indicates that as to providing advice to the Board of County Commissioners, which is one of the statutory duties that a state's attorney does have, what's happened is that she's offered advice and the state's attorney has offered advice as well, basically a second opinion. I don't think there's any displacement that occurs when it's handled appropriately. In this case, there's certainly no evidence that there was a displacement or a replacement of the state's attorney in any way. There's simply a contract that allows the Board of County Commissioners to, when it feels it's appropriate, engage a private firm for certain civil matters.
Now, are you saying then on the record it shows that every time they've sought civil advice, they got it from both counsel? Or on one occasion?
I don't know if it's clear in that regard, Justice Sabers. What it is basically a statement from counsel to the court that the way that providing advice to the board has operated up to that point is that both have participated. That the state's attorney has not been, you know, asked to leave the room or not perform those duties or anything of that kind. There simply wasn't evidence introduced on whether or not or to what degree the state's attorney is being displaced. I don't think there's any evidence that he has been.
No evidence either way on that issue. Are you saying that there's no record evidence either way on displacement?
There's no evidence on whether or not he was displaced. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yes. Okay.
There's also a statute that requires the state's attorney to provide legal advice and opinions to the Board of County Commissioners, and that's 716.8. Then there's what I call kind of the other category. There's a number of statutes that direct the state's attorney to provide certain legal representation. Most of those relate purely to criminal matters, examining all facts when an individual is committed to jail or bail, prosecuting preliminary informations, attending to grand juries, and so forth. There is then, third, within our statutory framework, a set of some procedures for engaging a private attorney. And Justice Sabers has alluded to one of those already, 716.2. What 716.2 allows is for circuit courts to actually appoint an attorney to perform certain duties of a state's attorney when he is either absent, unable to attend to his duties, or is adversely interested or disqualified. That statute goes on to authorize that court to deduct from the state's attorney's salary those fees. It's a special authorization for engaging private attorneys and deducting from the state's attorney's fees. That's not what has occurred here. There's been no reduction or diminishment of the state's attorney's salary. There's a second procedure, and perhaps even a third, where the Board of County Commissioners under 716.6 has the authority to employ counsel to assist the state's attorney when, and the statute reads, when opposing party employs two or more attorneys. It's an old statute, and we're probably not clear exactly what that means in terms of when you have a firm of five or more people, whether that's two or more. The case interpreting this particular statute, and if I were to cite this court to simply one case, it would be Grant County versus Jones, 177 Northwest 121. It's a 1920 case, but it analyzes 716.6. In that particular case, there was a state's attorney by the name of Robert Jones for Grant County, and a courthouse was constructed. There was a number of problems with the construction. The contractor defaulted. There were surety bond lawsuits, and as you've seen in contract litigation, a number of different parties in a number of different positions all trying to be reimbursed for their money. The state's attorney was representing the county in this complex litigation. then that state's attorney's term ended. The county chose to engage that state's attorney, former state's attorney, at this stage in the litigation, a private party attorney, to continue representing the county in that litigation to its conclusion. The county felt that it would be best preserving its rights and advocating for its fiscal responsibility by retaining that particular attorney who was familiar with the case. Apparently then what unfolded was there was perhaps a change in the composition of the county commissioners or something where the county commissioners withheld funds and decided not to honor its contract with that private attorney. So the former state's attorney brought suit to recover fees for legal services. And this court was then presented with the question of whether or not that contract was valid. This isn't directly on point, but I think it's highly compelling and a very good analysis for this court to review. What the court said was, even if we did not have 716.6, even if we had no such statute, we would have no hesitancy in holding that the county commissioners were vested with implied power to afford the state's attorney assistance when, owing to unusual circumstances, prudence required the same. The court even went on to say that if the county had not done so, it may have been, quote, remiss in its duties.
Well, what unusual circumstances are present here?
Again, there is not a record on what unusual circumstances are necessarily at play. What the particular context in this case revolves around is a county, and this is part of the record, that is partially within the boundaries of an Indian reservation and has a number of jurisdictional issues with regard to whether Blackacre is in or out of the county for purposes of tax rolls and for purposes of maintaining the fiscal funds for the county. That is, I think, what motivated the county to go out and seek civil representation on those type of very complex Indian law jurisdictional questions that involve those United States Supreme Court cases with your five plurality opinions and so forth that are constantly changing. And that was the reason that the county felt it was necessary, I think, to engage counsel. The contract itself doesn't spell that out. The contract itself simply allows the county to engage the firm when it chooses to do so, when it believes it will be best served by retaining that firm for its services.
I thought the contract, if I recall reading it correctly, required that the retained counsel be available for all meetings and be available for advice to all county officers.
That's correct. They have to be available. The Bogan Bogle law firm must be available present at all meetings, must be available at office hours and non-office hours, and must be available at their firm location near the county commissioners for consultation. So it's essentially a contract that requires them to be available whenever the county should call on them.
What limits it to civil? Or is that what you're suggesting, that the county can only do this under to contract when there are civil matters at issue? What in the statutes allows them to do it for civil?
I think, Justice Meyer-Henry, it's essentially the contract itself which limits it to civil. And what I'm arguing is that the existing statutory framework doesn't prohibit that, and in fact suggests that counties, in fulfilling their obligation to be sued and manage their fiscal responsibility, that is an implied power that's necessary in many circumstances to best carry out their roles as elected officials.
Then carrying it to the next level, could they also, if we were to rule in your favor, would that also mean then they could actually contract for the criminal portion of it as well?
That's not before the court, and I'm not arguing that, though. I do believe that those are inherently very, very different roles that a state's attorney performs. One is where he's essentially has a client, the Board of County Commissioners, and he is to perform duties and tasks as assigned by his client. The other is a completely different, the prosecutorial office, I think, is a completely different realm. I believe that this court's decision will ultimately be grounded on and look to the existing statutory framework, a matter of statutory interpretation of what the statutes do provide, as well as just policy considerations of what is best apt to help the local governments carry out their tasks and duties. There are a few inherent checks, I think, on what the county can do or can't do if our position would be adopted by the court. as we've said before, we're not asking for any authorization to reduce the state's attorney salary. I think that would be governed by 716-2, and we're not there. The county is going to be examined and reviewed by their electorate on how they spend their funds. They're also going to be subject to taxpayer fund suits if they abuse their discretion in doing so. Those are the checks that are on county commissioners in engaging contractors for contract work, for repairs and road work and so forth, as well as for this particular use, and employing a firm to best serve and give advice to the Board of County Commissioners.
Did the county get a letter opinion from any attorney as to whether or not this was legal or legitimate before doing it?
Not to my knowledge. It's certainly not a part of the record.
Now, normally we've said that the county commissioners would only have the power, the counties only have the power that the legislature delegates to the counties. And yet you're talking about inherent power. So how does that square with the restrictions of only having the power that's delegated by the legislature?
I think the Regents case is directly on point on that particular question, Justice Meyer-Henry, in that it says that the Regents have the power to sue and be sued. Necessarily implied within that power is the power to engage and hire counsel of their own choosing. It's a necessary component of that particular power. So we're not asking for an expansion of their existing powers. We're simply asking for the means to carry that power out. I don't know if the court wants me to get into Senate Bill 185. I don't know if the court is aware of that or wants any particular discussion on it. It really was not a part of the record below, since it was considered by the legislature subsequent to Judge Johnson's opinion, but I'm certainly willing to discuss that and offer any argument on that particular issue. Okay. Let me just, I guess, explain briefly what that is for just for the record. That was a legislative bill, Senate Bill 185, that was considered by the Senate, was actually approved and enacted by both the Senate and the House in February 2004, that would have essentially resolved this particular case. It gave explicit authority to the county to employ civil counsel on certain matters when it deemed best to do so. It was ultimately vetoed by Governor Rounds, and so it's really not any kind of legislative history that I think is instructive in any way. I would cite the court to Hot Springs School District Case 262 Northwest 2nd 33, which says that legislative interpretation through amendments is not necessarily binding on the court, and we don't even have an amendment in this case. We have a bill that was considered and ultimately simply not enacted.
Did the governor veto it because the issue was pending before us?
Justice Konenkamp, I really don't know the reason. I just don't know. Obviously, there could have been a number of reasons.
So the veto message is not in the record?
It's not, because it occurred subsequent to the lower court's decision.
All right.
I think it was probably in part at least motivated by it, but it's not certainly a part of that record. Ultimately, I believe this court has three options before it: to affirm the decision below, to reverse as we advocate based upon the implied power of the county commissioners to do what they did here, and simply approve the contract as written. Third, and this is an option which we are not advocating, but I think is kind of suggested in the appellant's or the appellee's reply brief, to consider some sort of remand. If the court believes that this sort of contract should be allowed, perhaps something like on the terms that the legislative bill provided, perhaps something that would include the requirement of a showing of need, or the showing that there hasn't been a displacement, facts that really weren't considered or examined below. Perhaps an examination of the specialization that the firm that the board wants to hire would bring to the table. That would have to be in the context of a remand, because those types of issues and evidence and facts simply were not discussed or presented below.
Now, when you refer to need, are you talking about that you brought out in your brief that the current state's attorney is also an associate justice of the Standing Rock Tribal Court?
Correct.
All right. What is your position on the fact that SDCL 716-18 says, quote, No state's attorney while in office is eligible to hold any judicial office, unquote.
I believe that's basically a separate issue, Justice Gilbertson. It's a disqualification type of issue. It's simply not before the court, but I acknowledge.
So that, would that fall into your suggestion on a remand, since it wasn't looked at by the trial court the first time out, or what? What do we do with it?
It could.
Okay.
If we were to remand in accordance with your option number three, wouldn't that really be giving you the second bite at the same apple?
Well, Justice Sabers, I don't really believe so, because I don't think that was evidence that was really gotten into by either side below. It simply wasn't, because it wasn't presented either way.
But, I mean, if you need it to sustain your case, if you need to show need, if you need to show unusual circumstances, and you haven't, isn't it giving you a second bite of the apple?
I don't know that that's our burden. That would be for the court to define. It certainly wasn't our burden below, because that wasn't part of the existing law.
Any further questions? If not, counsel, your time has expired. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Anson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Elton Anson, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Curtis W. Hanks. He's the Corson County State's Attorney. And the facts of the case can be summed up quite briefly. Mr. Hanks became the duly elected State's Attorney for Corson County in the year 2001, and Corson County entered into a contract with Bogue & Bogue January 7th of 2003, wherein Bogue was required to provide all civil representation regarding the county as may be requested in state, federal, and tribal courts as set forth in SDCL 716. Mr. Hanks was not consulted regarding this contract, nor did he appoint Bogue to be his deputy. Mr. Hanks never refused or was unable to perform his duties. He was never disqualified or adversely interested in any case.
Well, now, on this disqualification issue, you have a blatant violation your client's admitted to in 716.18, where it says no state's attorney while in office is eligible to hold any judicial office. I'm wondering if your client's even the valid state's attorney.
I believe that relates to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, Your Honor.
Right.
Instead of a state court.
It doesn't say state court. It says any judicial office.
Well, I believe the problem would be on the Standing Rock Reservation, where he would be disqualified from holding that office, instead of reversing it and saying
this
he can't
have the
state's
attorneys. This
chapter
doesn't deal with judges. It deals with state's attorneys.
Yes.
So my question again is he disqualified as a state's attorney for violating a prohibition on being a judge?
That isn't an issue from the case below, Your Honor, and it's being raised here or in the brief for the first time. Maybe we should look at it this way. A county is held to its minutes. That's the way it speaks. We can't go back as counsel and say, well, I believe this is what the county was saying, or this is the reason that this contract was entered into.
If this wasn't an issue below, then why did your client sign a stipulation conceding that he serves as an associate justice of the Standing Rock Tribal Court?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I believe he felt it probably wasn't an issue.
He signs it as a it's labeled a stipulation, but he signed it. I mean, what are we to do with that?
Well, again, the interpretation that I would advance is that he would be disqualified, if anything, if that were truly the case, he would be disqualified from being on the bench at the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. I don't know that that would disqualify him from being a state's attorney, Your Honor.
The state statutes don't even apply to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. They make their own laws.
Exactly.
So how can you say it applies to disqualify him as a judge rather than a state's attorney?
I'm getting back to the case at hand, Your Honor, and saying that wasn't an issue that the county even considered when they entered into this contract. And he's never been judicially disqualified from holding that office. And in addition, he's never requested any assistance by outside counsel. On the appeal, Judge Johnson reversed the board's decision and stated that the board was without legal authority to substitute the lawyer of its choice for the lawyer that followed the proper procedure and became the elected state's attorney for Corson County. The circuit court held that the board had entered into a contract with Bogue that assumes duties which Mr. Hanks is required by law to carry out as the duly elected state's attorney. And we've talked briefly about some of the statutes that apply, 716.9 specifically stating that that state's attorney shall appear in the courts of his county. 716.8, the state's attorney shall give opinions to the county commissioners and the other county officers if requested. And the state's attorney is also required to represent the county in all civil and criminal proceedings held outside the county on the cases that do originate within the county and are transferred elsewhere, for instance, due to a change of venue, and that's 716.15. So the issue before the court today is whether the counties have legal authority to contract for civil legal matters venued in the county. And maybe that's overbroad, but that's the way counsel stated the issue in brief. Because there are instances addressed in statute whereby a county can contract for the duties of state's attorney or where special counsel may be appointed, but this just isn't one of those cases. We're bound by the facts in this case, and the fact is there were no pending litigation issues. There were no issues that would require any other expertise in what was already available to the county in the form of the duly elected state's attorney. Counsel talks about an older case out of the 20s coming out of Grant County. And if you look closely at that case, you'll see that it really doesn't apply because that was a case where the duly elected state's attorney did not oppose the hiring of the previous state's attorney to take care of matters that were pending during the transition. So that state's attorney was on board for the county entering into a contract like that. So I don't think that case really applies here, where you don't have the state's attorney being consulted, you don't have his input, and you don't have his oversight over the person who's been hired under contract. And I think that's another important point.
How do you distinguish Board of Regents versus Carter?
The Board of Regents case is a case that looked at the constitutional duties of the Attorney General and that examined that in context of the Board of Regents. Here we've got a statutory framework that we're working with as state's attorneys and county commissions are concerned that clearly lays out the duties of what that state's attorney shall do. There isn't anything saying, you know, the Attorney General shall represent the Board of Regents at this hearing or this proceeding. What they were doing is taking a look at that in context of a constitutional type of argument. And there's a case within the Board of Regents case itself that goes back called the Wells case. And I think the court, when it addressed the Wells case, made some good points about the responsibilities, in that instance, of the Attorney General, and probably applicably the state's attorney, and how they should have oversight and input when there is a contract attorney involved. And that's the question about a contract attorney. Who are they responsible to? The Board of County Commission? Are they responsible to the state's attorney? They're certainly not responsible to the taxpayers under this type of an arrangement. And when you deprive the state's attorney of any oversight or any input as far as litigation that that contract attorney may undertake, you've taken away his powers and his duties as well.
Shouldn't there be some power on behalf of the county commission if there really is a problem with the state's attorney representing him in civil matters? How do you propose to address an issue where they do have a very significant some civil matters and the state's attorney is not responding to their requests?
Well, there are also statutes for the removal of a state's attorney for failure or refusal to act. Most of the time, in common practice, what happens is if a state's attorney doesn't have the precise litigation experience or the expertise, they will have a deputy state's attorney come in under contract and take over in those areas, but remain taking part in that action and giving the oversight to that action, and thus remaining responsible for what happens in that litigation. But there are elsewhere statutes that deal with this. You know, special counsel that could assist a trial, that could be appointed. If there's a position that's open because no one ran at the election, you know, that's able to be filled by appointment. But again, this isn't that type of a case. This is a case where if you look at those minutes, and they're bound by the minutes, there is no recitation of any need for any additional legal service. There's no recitation of any ongoing litigation. This issue of Indian law and that sort of thing, that comes up after the fact and is basically an assumption on the part of counsel. That doesn't appear in the minutes. And
was it presented to Judge Johnson as a justification at trial?
I believe somewhere in the transcript it does appear, but again, that comes up after the fact, way after the contract was even entered into. They're going back, and once it's in court being contested, they're saying, well, this is the reason that we did it. But a county is bound by its minutes. That's how it speaks. And there's nothing in those minutes to say why they even need outside counsel.
Is there some statutory authority you can cite us to that says it has to go in the minutes? I mean, the fact there was a contract was in the minutes.
I don't have that before me right now, Your Honor, but I could certainly submit that if you would like.
All right.
The counsel does cite a couple of other cases in their briefs, and maybe if I do have time here, I'd like to touch on those. The Tobin case, again, a case that doesn't match the fact patterns that we have here. The Tobin case dealt with a state's attorney undertaking specific legal representation outside of his county and a dispute over the billing after that was completed. And here, again, we have no pending litigation and no reason to enter into a contract, so the cite to the Tobin case really isn't applicable. And on page 763 of the Tobin case, the court says Tobin, as the state's attorney, was the legal consultant for the county and was obliged to place before the county commission all of the law on the subject. So there's a recognition that he is, in fact, the legal counsel for the county. If the legislature intended the state's attorneys to be allowed extra compensation, it could have easily said so. That's the other thing that Tobin talks about. Just like this, if they had intended for the counties to be able to go out and enter into contracts with contract lawyers displacing the state's attorney, they would have said so. Other states have done it. There are sites in the council's brief to Illinois. That's a state where specifically in statute it said by a majority vote the county commission can enter into a contract with an outside attorney. We don't have that in South Dakota. And if we needed it, or if the legislature intended that we have it, they would have said so. And they haven't.
What about the argument that there's inherent power for them to be able to hire a lawyer? And what if they're at odds with the state's attorney, for instance? Under your analysis of the statutes, they would never be able to hire their own lawyer to challenge anything. Is that right?
I don't necessarily believe that to be true. I think you have to look at those statutes together. They have the right to sue and be sued. The law says the state's attorney represents the county in these matters. Thereby, they're given the ability to sue and be sued, and they also have the ability or the framework in place where they're represented by the state's attorney in those two. And again, if they are at odds, there's certainly nothing to say that they can't at least work together and bring in a deputy state's attorney or a special state's attorney to handle the matter. Or if it gets to that point, there's the removal action, if need be. But that's not what's before the court today. There's been no refusal to act by Mr. Hanks. There's been no judicial disqualification. He didn't ask for any additional assistance by a contract attorney. And he's basically been displaced under the contract.
What about the suggestion of remanding it with some criteria, findings on showing a need or something of that nature?
I don't believe a remand would be appropriate, Your Honor. I think what you're dealing with here and what the circuit court recognizes, you have a void contract because the county is without the authority to enter into this contract with Bogue, so there's no need to remand. You can't breathe life back into that void contract. I think maybe the court, if anything, needs to delineate the structure here and say that you can't usurp a standing state's attorney and simply put his duties out on contract with another attorney.
That's assuming he's validly holding office, correct?
Sure, under this assumption, that's correct.
Okay.
But you seem to acknowledge there are or could be situations where separate civil counsel could be retained.
Yes, and you know, in practice, that happens. Not too many years ago, there was a case against the railroad, and many counties joined into that. But many state's attorneys didn't have that expertise or weren't willing to devote that level of time to take part in that. So what they did was hire outside counsel and appointed them, in many instances, to be special deputies to undertake that litigation.
So there must be some implied authority to do it in certain circumstances.
Right, and those are the statutes that I've talked about here this morning. And reading those together, you see how that would work.
Well, I didn't hear you say anything that would allow just for specialized work by, say, bond counsel or securities counsel or something like that.
Sure, and that's been done in practice. How that happens is the state's attorney is able, under the statutes, to appoint a deputy or a special deputy. And I don't know if I specifically cited that statute, but it is in 716 with the other duties and responsibilities of the state's attorney. And that's 716.3, Your Honor. And that person, you know, that's a good point. That person does serve, when they are appointed under 716.3, at the explicit supervision and control of the state's attorney. And I think it's important that the legislature put that in there, because the intent there is that someone remains responsible. The state's attorney remains responsible, even though he's not the one sitting at counsel table. He's responsible. And to say that we could just take all of that away and give it to a contract lawyer, then you have the question of who's responsible. And counsel had mentioned Senate Bill 185, and that's interesting because basically that's an admission that counties are without legal authority to enter into this type of contract. It dealt specifically with this type of a case. The governor did veto it, as you talked about. He vetoed it for one reason, because the case was pending before the court. And the other reason was he was uneasy about the fact that the state's attorney wasn't consulted or a part of the process. And he was uneasy with that aspect. And that's precisely what happened in this case. And I think we need to take a look at the danger in taking away the rights of the voters to be represented by the person that they put into office. And that's precisely what happens in this type of a case.
Now, a decision from this court's going to have impact beyond this case.
It certainly is. It's going to impact every county in the state.
What about the situation where it's been alluded to earlier in the argument today, where the state's attorney and the county are at odds over something, and they can't agree or get along, or they're taking adverse positions, say perhaps on a legal issue? What's a county to do in that situation? The state's attorney won't appoint a deputy. County does not agree with the legal opinion that's being given, and they want to advocate an interest different than that being advocated by the state's attorney.
Okay, and again, that isn't the case that we have before us. That doesn't fit the facts, and with that in mind, I think at some point you would get to the removal statutes. And I think at some point you could even involve the Attorney General's office, you know. They do have legal oversight of the state's attorneys.
Those are the easy answers. I'm trying to determine if there is some limited implied power in this chapter.
Well, maybe an example would be this type of a case where they're at odds, and then the statute comes into play where they're certainly able to hire counsel. They motion to the court appoints counsel to handle that litigation. And the state's attorney proceeds in his role. So, you know, we do have statutes in place for that type of thing. Basically, Your Honors, I just ask that you affirm the ruling of the court below, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Hanson. Mr. Simmons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I think the particular issue where you have a county and the state's attorney at odds and that attorney-client relationship breaking down to the detriment of the county is probably part of what's present here. And obviously the personal relationship between that state's attorney and that Board of County Commissioners is not relevant for your decision today, but I think it does illustrate that does occur from time to time, where the Board of County Commissioners and the state's attorney have an interference, for whatever reason, between their ability to communicate effectively. The question, I think, is here, who's the client? It's the Board of County Commissioners. And the state's attorney is to serve that board and represent their interests. At times, there's going to be circumstances where, for a number of different reasons, that relationship breaks down, and the county cannot be held hostage by a state's attorney who refuses to follow their own procedures by appointing a deputy, or where the other statutory provisions just simply don't apply, where there's not two attorneys on the other side, or where there's not a direct conflict of interest and so forth.
Don't you have who the client is wrong? The client is the people in the county who've elected the state's attorney and who have elected the county commissioners, and both are agents for the people who are the client and the employer, so to speak, of the county commissioners.
It's a very unique attorney-client relationship,
right.
Mr. Savers.
But the county commissioners are not the client.
I don't know if I think you may be correct in going so far as to say they are the client is not directly applicable, because it is such a unique relationship. It's not your standard attorney-client relationship. But I think the Board of County Commissioners is the elected board which speaks for the entity which is the county government. And it's the state's attorney's role in connection with civil litigation and advice and counsel to work with that particular group of people who have been elected by the electorate.
Is there anything in the record that shows that he's refused to work with them?
I don't believe there is. I don't believe there's evidence one way or the other on that. I just think the fact that this litigation is before the court suggests or illustrates that there's some sort of tension there, which is going to be present from time to time and won't be capable of being resolved by the specific procedures that are provided by statute.
Now, in your first presentation, you relied heavily on Grant County versus Jones, and Mr. Hanks says, well, that's not applicable because there, the existing state's attorney agreed to the hiring of his predecessor. Is that true?
I don't know if that's actually part of that decision or not. I know that there is not any evidence cited within that decision that says the state's attorney did, you know, objected to it. I don't know if that necessarily changes the legal issue presented, though, in the ability of the county to shepherdize and look after its own interests. And it's particularly relevant in a case like this where the state's attorney doesn't consent, where there's a loggerhead there, and where things have broken down. I think the Grant County case, and again, it is not directly applicable, but is extremely helpful in the sense that it analyzes and it discusses the importance of a county to have legal representation that it needs to carry out its roles. And in fact, looks at the existing statutory framework for getting a substitute or an assistant or a deputy and says, we are not necessarily going to be bound by those strict procedural rules. We're going to look at the implied authority and power of a county government to hire legal counsel when they need to. The Regents case was mentioned as well, and I'd like to just go back to that for a second in the sense that the Attorney General in that case did essentially argue just exactly what the state's attorney is arguing here. The Attorney General's office had taken the position that it was the sole constitutional office that could perform the representation of and for the Board of Regents. It was almost an exact mimic of the precise argument made here with regards to a state's attorney in the county. And the court ultimately said that the power to sue and be sued necessarily implies the means necessary to carry out that power, and granted the regents the authority to hire and select their own attorney for the litigation at hand.
Would it make a difference in the contract if the lawyer only gave them legal advice as opposed to representing them in court or pursuing a lawsuit?
It would be a different case. It would certainly be a different case if the contract had more contours to it and more specifics, and it simply doesn't. The contract that you're presented with basically allows the county, and part of that, Justice Minor Henry, I think, is the fact that this comes from Portion County. This is not Minnehaha County. If it were Minnehaha County, they would identify specific engagement that the hired firm was going to perform. They'd be able to do that. the volume of work in this particular county and the probably the sporadic nature of it from being a very small issue here or a larger issue here made it most efficient for them to define the contract simply as, we'll call you when we need you. Whenever we call you, you have to be there.
Doesn't it go beyond that, though? As I see the contract language, it says that the contract attorney shall be responsible for performing all civil representation regarding the county. And I believe it goes on to say it's under Chapter 716.
It references Chapter 716. It says all civil representation regarding the county as may be requested in state, federal, and tribal courts. And part of that is not an issue before the court. I think both parties have agreed that for matters venued outside the county, that's clearly authorized. And so the contract itself is not, I don't think, void. I think it's been limited in its effect by the ruling below, but not necessarily voided, because part of the contract was basically approved and ratified.
Well, what does it mean when it says they're going to represent them in all civil proceedings? Isn't that effectively displacement?
Well, I don't think so, Judge Zinter, or Justice Zinter, because I think what the contract is allowing the county to do is, as I said, kind of call the Bogan Bogue law firm when they need them. I don't think that it's intended to completely displace the state's attorney on all matters. There's certainly no evidence in that regard. What it allows the county to do is call that firm when they need them from time to time. And it says all civil representation because they wanted to be able to say, you're not going to be able to decline representation if we call you. We want you to be available at all times. So I don't know if I've answered that question appropriately, but I see what you're saying in terms of the contract would allow them to use the Bogan Bogue law firm on all cases and in all respects. I don't think that's necessarily what was contemplated, and there's not any evidence that would present exactly how that contract was actually used and operated under.
Now, in the argument by Mr. Hanks, he said that you're coming up with excuses after the facts because the commissioner minutes at the time the contract was entered into did not list these explanations. What's your response?
Chief Justice Gilbertson, are you speaking directly with regard to the associate justice appointment?
No, I'm speaking, if I understood Mr. Anson correctly, he's saying that the explanations you gave to Judge Johnson at trial were after the fact because and not appropriate because they were not contained in the commissioner minutes as reasons for entering into the contract with the Bogues.
The contract was attacked by Mr. Hanks. I think he would have the burden of showing that for some reason it was illegal or inappropriate. There was no requirement under the law at that time, certainly, to present minutes or findings by the county commissioners as to why a contract was necessary. So it is true that when the case went before Judge Johnson, there was explanations as to why this was done, and part of the reason related to the fact that he's a member of Associate Justice on the Standing Rock Tribal Court, and that related primarily at that point, as I understand it, not necessarily to a disqualification argument, but a conflict of interest. And whether it actually rose to the level of 716-6 or not, it was a concern that the county had and wanted to make sure that it was obtaining appropriate legal advice free of any potential conflict of interest that Mr. Hanks might have.
Let me ask you one thing, the flip side of a question that's been asked before. Would you concede that the county does not have authority to completely displace the state's attorney on civil representation?
I would. I think if there were evidence that the state's attorney were completely displaced or supplanted, that might affect his or her constitutional office. There is no evidence in this case that that has occurred, and I don't think the contract necessarily contemplates that occurring either. And as I said before, there's a statement from Attorney Bogue in the transcript where she's explaining how this has worked. Up to that point, there hadn't been any litigation other than this particular litigation. And on advice and counsel matters, they had worked together. There had been no displacement. That would be a different case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.